I'm David Manilow. Welcome to The Dining Table, a place where we gather to share the good things in life. In a minute, I'll give you my list of the four essential types of sandwiches that every Chicagoan should try at least once. We'll also head to the Crane's newsroom to chat with Ali Marotti about the impact of inflation on restaurants in the fast casual and quick service categories. Plus, my enlightening conversation with filmmaker Rebecca Halperin, the writer-director of Love, Charlie, The Rise and Fall of Chef Charlie Trotter. There's some really interesting stuff about his complicated relationship with Chef Grant Achatz of Alinea fame.
That to hear Grant admit that now that he finds himself acting like Charlie Trotter all the time is pretty explosive.
I was talking to a friend of mine recently who's lived in Chicago for like 20 years, and as it turned out, she told me, she's never had an Italian beef sandwich. And I'm like, you've lived here way too long to not have had an essential Chicago sandwich. So I sent her out to Johnny's Beef in Elmwood Park. I told her how I like it, dipped with hot peppers, maybe occasional hot, sweet mixed. Get a little messy, eat it while you're there, enjoy the experience. But it did get me thinking about what are the other great sandwiches that every Chicagoan should try at least once. The first one, I think, is the Jibarito. Jibarito is Chicago's own Puerto Rican sandwich made with fried, smashed plantains. They put mayo on one of the plantains, lettuce, tomato, cheese. I like it with pork. Some people get chicken. Some people will get steak. But they use the plantains instead of the bread. I like going to one of the original ones, which is Borinquen. Borinquen used to be a kind of more in Humboldt Park. Now it's on Western, a little farther north. There's also Jibarito y Mas, which has four locations. But if you've never tried a Jibarito, which is just plantain Puerto Rican fabulousness, you should absolutely. Another sandwich you should try is a banh mi sandwich, which is Vietnamese. I usually go to Nu Lan, which is on Lawrence Avenue. They have 20 different kinds of banh mi sandwiches. They have chicken banh mi, meatball, pate, pork, several different kinds of vegetarian sandwiches. They're usually served with pickled daikon and carrot, thick cucumber spears, fresh cilantro, and sliced jalapenos on home-baked rolls. And they're fabulous. I usually get two. Sometimes I get a vegetarian, and maybe I'll get a meatball, one hot, one cold. You should absolutely try them. There are banh mi's at lots of Vietnamese restaurants around town, so you can't go wrong. I go to Nu Lan on Lawrence because I've been going there for years. And finally, even though I think most Chicagoans have had this, you should try a gyros. Gyros is usually made with lamb, but I was talking to a friend of mine who runs a Greek travel agency, and she said, if you want a gyros, like they make them in Greece, they're actually made with pork. And the best one that she knows of is Charcoal Flame in Morton Grove. So I headed out to Charcoal Flame in Morton Grove, and it was fabulous. I will say they carve it right off the spit. I'm not saying pork is necessarily better than lamb, but this was a really, really great gyros, Charcoal Flame in Morton Grove. There's plenty of places all throughout town, whether you go to Greek town, you go to a little place in the suburbs of the city, you should try a gyros. So the four that you got to try are an Italian beef sandwich, a Jibarito, a banh mi, and a gyros. And then you're living a good life in Chicago. Restaurant and food reporter Ali Marotti joins me now. How's it going, Ali?
It's going great. How are you, David?
I'm great. So you have some news on Portillo's.
Yes. So Portillo's has been public for a little over a year now. So I've been watching, you know, their performance on the stock market and listening to their quarterly earnings calls. And they had one just recently, and they talked a little bit about their strategy with inflation. So obviously inflation is up. Everyone's feeling it. Everyone's dealing with it in the grocery stores, at restaurants, et cetera. And Portillo's has taken this strategy, and they kind of started it, you know, earlier this year. And the CEO says it's a long game, but basically what they're going to try to do is keep their prices down in comparison to competitors so that Portillo's is still a value to customers. And, you know, the CEO gave a little bit of an update on how that's going, and it seems like the results are mixed, right? The number of entrees that they sell is slightly up in the last quarter, not that much. It was really closer to flat. But interestingly, Portillo's is one that everybody thought would do really, really well as a public company because they're so good at getting people through the line quickly. You know, I think anybody who's been to Portillo's is always a little bit amazed by that. So they can do that, which means they can keep their revenues up, which means they can fuel their growth, which is something that people always look for in a public company, right? Can they grow as fast as they say that they're going to? Portillo's is still doing that. They're still growing really quickly. But in this inflationary environment, a lot of investors are looking at their margins too. And those are down because of inflation. Basically, their costs are up because they sell so much meat. You know, the labor costs are up. As they expand, it costs more to build their stores out that they're trying to, you know, get into new markets. And then at the same time, they're not raising their menu prices as much as some of their competitors. It kind of has investors worried a little bit.
Yeah, but it makes sense, especially if they're introducing themselves to new markets, to try to come in at a fairly low price point. And because, you know, we're here and maybe that's an alternative that some of these people who don't know Portillo's or know only from Chicago say, oh, I'll give this place a try.
Yeah, that's exactly the strategy. And it's interesting because I also cover McDonald's, you know, which is another one where it's seen as a value, right? And I think for the better part of this year, we've been seeing when they're pinching their own pennies, the consumers, they're maybe trading down, basically going from maybe a more expensive restaurant like a Chipotle to something a little bit cheaper like a McDonald's. And even McDonald's customers have been gravitating toward the value menu. So you can see it playing out, you know, where people are really trying to cut back on their spending, but still eating out. However, I looked at some data recently. It's from Rabobank, a market research firm, and they found that in the third quarter, we are starting to see people going out to eat less. And that is hitting basically every type of restaurant from, you know, your dine-in to your quick service like Chipotle to your fast casual or fast food, as a lot of people know it as. And everybody's starting to feel, you know, that heat a little bit.
Right. Well, two things. I don't know that you would know that people are going out to eat less if you base it on the West Loop, because I've been to two restaurants on Tuesday nights, including last night at El Che, which is on Washington, you know, off of Halsted. Packed on a Tuesday night. I was at Joya. Packed on a Tuesday night. Packed. But I do want to come back to one thing you said about getting people through the line very fast at Portillo's, because I grew up going to the original Potbellies on Lincoln Avenue with the Potbelly stove, right? The original, that's what it was called, Potbellies. And it was the only one forever. And then somebody came about and said, oh, I'm going to buy this and expand it because the whole thing you're talking about, because you guys have a system to get people through the line really fast.
Yep. And I'm glad you brought them up because they just reported their earnings too. And they're doing decently well. They've done in the past couple of years, a couple, you know, reboots, turnarounds. They got, remember they used to have that guitar player strumming away in there while you were in line, and you would wait in line and see them making your sandwich. They did away with the guitar player. They tried doing away with the line, and then they've come back and they've said, actually, we do want that line there. They've changed their menu. And now their newest thing is that they're trying to franchise, and that's going to be the way that they grow. And they're doing it. You know, they've signed a few big franchisee agreements in other states, and, you know, they're kind of off to the races with that.
Sounds a little scattershot to me, though.
It is. You know, to see them try to launch so many turnarounds so quickly, I think definitely had investors concerned. Their stock did not do well for a while there. But, you know, using the franchisee model to grow is kind of a well-worn path that a lot of people have taken, including Potbellies themselves at different points, you know, throughout their history. The trick is doing it the right way, right? Because you still have to build out your distribution models, make sure you're not extending yourself too far. And that's something with their strategy, it seems like they're going on the right path, experts tell me. You know, you focus on maybe just Florida. It's similar to what Portillo's does too, just Arizona. Then you build that out instead of opening, you know, one restaurant in 20 different cities.
I do think there should be more guitar players at restaurants, just because why not?
It's a nice touch.
It just should be. Okay, I have a question for you. Since we're talking about kind of a higher end fast food chains, do you have like a favorite? Do you have a favorite couple of the ones we talked about or others?
Oh, you know, I started going to Potbelly when I was in college, and I love the toasted bread, mm-hmm. you know. Portillo's, I will never forget my first cake shake, you know. And every time I write about it, I crave the cake or the cake shake. And I really have to refrain myself. One time last year, I was writing a story about how they were doing, you know, relaunching their app and working on all that kind of stuff. And I went and bought a cake and brought it into the newsroom because I couldn't resist the urging any longer.
You know, it's funny because when I used to work for Channel 7, which is on Staten Lake, there wasn't many restaurants around there. So I became a Wendy's fan because that was like mm-hmm. my, you know, after the 6 o'clock news, and before the 10 o'clock news, we would go to Wendy's, you know, and have a frosty. Although I'm a Potbellies guy from way back. My family, I think, is a little bit more of Chipotle, just in general. I think they like Chipotle.
What about you? Are you changing your eating out habits because of inflation at all? Buying one less glass of wine, anything like that?
Yes and no. I stopped spending a whole bunch of money on wine and alcohol at restaurants because during the pandemic, early pandemic, I went down the kind of buying spirits and creating cocktails rabbit hole. Mm-hmm. So I started getting actually some elevated, you know, tequila and bourbon. And so where I would have never had a glass of bourbon or something by myself at home in the past, that's what I do now, just kind of like to chill out. And so in a bottle of wine with, you know, the 3 or 4 times markup, kind of the same thing. So I do spend less money on alcohol, and I've never been a huge steak eater, so I'm not, you know, I see some of those prices of steaks these days and it just like, you know, blows my mind. So I guess I'm partially avoiding your question, but partially it just kind of came about that I just don't, yeah, I think so. If I cut back on spending, it's almost always wine and spirits.
Well, you had set yourself up well then for inflation.
Or I got a little manic, one or the other. Something changed. I don't know what it was. But I always also, by the way, had a rule that I instituted when I was in college, which was this. And it worked through college, and I've never violated this rule. I promised myself that I would never drink or party, no matter how you want to describe it, more than 3 days in a row. So in college, that meant if I had something on a Wednesday, I would have to avoid the Thursday so I could go out on Friday and Saturday. So I've always managed to just kind of like pace myself wherever it comes to consumption.
That is really smart. I try to usually do at least 3 days a week without alcohol consumption, but it's hard.
You know, and also with stuff coming back and restaurants are coming back and there's events and things like that, it's, you know, it's enticing.
Yep. And you know, when I'm talking to all these restaurant operators, they're telling me that they're getting slammed with event requests because, you know, the past couple of years, particularly last year, it was, let's have these little small holiday gatherings with our people. But now it seems what I'm hearing is that people are wanting to have the full size parties again.
Well, maybe we'll explore that another time. Allie, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Charlie Trotter. From Charlie Trotter's restaurant in Chicago.
Is he good?
We can just use this mic.
Oh, no, no, because I wanted to say something that I don't want recorded.
Oh.
My philosophy has always been, if it weren't for employees and if it weren't for the customers, the restaurant business would be the greatest business in the world.
I'm here with Rebecca Halpern, writer-director of Love, Charlie, The Rise and Fall of Chef Charlie Trotter. Chef Trotter was a culinary genius, sometimes petty, always passionate. Thanks so much for joining me, Rebecca. Tell me why you decided to do the project.
Well, I was invited to direct this film by producer Rene Frigo, who was the founder of Lucchini Olive Oil, which Charlie had discovered. And I grew up in Chicago, went to Charlie's high school, New Trier, and my mom was a food writer in the city. And so when I was 10 years old, Charlie Trotter opened his restaurant, and he literally exploded onto the scene. And I remember my mom talking about him like he was some kind of unicorn, you know, sent here from heaven to revolutionize American cuisine. And as time went on, and over the next 20 years or so, I watched Charlie Trotter's career take off, and then I watched it start to falter as taste changed and competition sort of ignited with some of his proteges like Grant Achatz.
I had that romantic notion that it was art. And if you don't realize in order to achieve that, you almost have to endure the opposite. Grueling, hard labor, sacrifice was what it took to get the result of beauty.
And I always wondered, like, who is this Chef Charlie Trotter person really? And so when I was given the opportunity to direct, that was the sort of driving force behind my storytelling. It was always trying to get to the heart of not the caricature that the media would have you believe, but the real person himself.
I had a job when I was 16 at a place in Wilmette.
Good news today at the Ground Round.
And part of their shtick was, we'll start these people off with peanuts, and then we encourage you to throw the shells on the floor. It creates a nice ambiance, and we like that. It's casual. And I thought that was kind of disgusting, so I was always trying to sweep up the peanuts, and the manager would come over and say, no, leave those there. We want them there.
You know, it's a great film if you're interested in Trotter or restaurants or creativity or power, but it's especially good if you live in Chicago or spent time here. And people don't realize that in 1987, when Trotter opened it and lasted for 25 years on Armitage, how huge he was, both in the city and nationally.
Yeah, no, I mean, his legacy definitely stands to be lost to time. And I think it's because he came up in the sort of pre-social media era. You know, he also wasn't as, what I'll call, say, charismatic maybe, or easily relatable as like Emeril Lagasse, his best friend. So when the Food Network came along, you know, Charlie was going in a different, more intellectual direction. He had just launched his first cookbook, which he financed himself, and revolutionized the way food is photographed. In many respects, Charlie Trotter, I guess you could say, is the godfather of food porn. Our Instagram feeds would not look like they do. Chef's Table would not be shot like it's shot, but for Charlie Trotter and the photography that he pioneered in his coffee table style cookbooks.
Right. He was also an incredibly important figure in Chicago because of the chefs that he had under him. Graham Elliott, Giuseppe Tintori, Mindy Siegel, Art Smith, Bill Kim, Curtis Duffy, Matthias Marriages, all these guys that went on to really create wonderful restaurants of their own. And of course, Grant Achatz, but they all kind of were tutored by Trotter in his restaurant first.
Yeah, I mean, the flock of protégés that came through Trotter's door is pretty remarkable, and the reach of Trotter is remarkable. All of these protégés come out of the woodwork in all of these different markets across the country. People who were either worked for him or were inspired by him. And it's really great to see, because especially now, so many of the current generation of young upstart chefs don't even have a clue who he was. So to be able to cement his legacy this way and sort of introduce him to the world that stands on his shoulders is a real gift to me, to be able to do that for him and his family and his legacy.
You have an interesting, I guess, interplay with Grant Achatz, who's one of the most famous chefs in the world right now, from Alinea. And Achatz and Trotter's, I would call, complicated relationship, where Grant Achatz read one of Trotter's early books, wrote Trotter a letter every day to try to work there, and then finally Trotter called him up. And then Grant Achatz worked there, described it as cutthroat, a little bit chaotic, and they became both friends, enemies, competitors, all at the same time.
Grant, when he got in the kitchen, the scales fell from his eyes, and he saw Charlie not for this mythological figure that he had built up in his mind, but as a relentless excellencist who was on a singular quest to do every single thing in his life to do it to a level of excellence that very, very, very few people can attain.
He made himself a really vulnerable, easy target. He was an outlier. He didn't play by the rules. So when I got diagnosed in 2007 with tongue cancer, and I was in the middle of my chemo, I was really frail, really bad shape. And I got an invitation from him. He was having an open house at his home in Lincoln Park. And I went, and he gave a speech, and he said, you know, Chef Grant's going through this horrific battle, and we're we need to be here for him, and, you know, this whole big thing. I never knew if we were friends or we were enemies. And I think we were kind of both. And I think he wanted it that way. In a weird way, he was making me, like, want to be him.
When he saw how Charlie handled not only him, but other chefs in the kitchen, and just the way Charlie was, you know, Grant decided it wasn't right for him. And he went and worked for Thomas Keller, who he developed a very close relationship with. And then when he came back, obviously, you know, Chicago media loves a good beef. And there you go. Grant Achatz versus Charlie Trotter. I will say one more thing about this. If this had not been a biopic about Charlie Trotter, I think the real most compelling story to be told about Chicago chefs is the cyclical nature of chefdom, what it means to be an auteur chef, told through the lens of Charlie Trotter's relationship with Grant Achatz, and how, you know, if you look at the two of them, they were on a parallel path. Charlie exploded onto the scene for his style of cuisine. Grant did the same thing. Charlie skyrocketed, you know, to heights that no Chicago chef had ever skyrocketed to. Same with Grant. Now, 17 years on for Alinea, you know, people are starting to criticize Grant and Alinea's style of cooking for the same things that they criticized Charlie for back in the day. And Grant even says, I don't want to ruin it for anyone, but in the film, the journey we present that Grant goes on is pretty remarkable when you think about the fact that all you've heard in Chicago media is how much they hate each other. That to hear Grant admit that now that he finds himself acting like Charlie Trotter all the time is pretty explosive. And, it was really exciting to me to be sitting across from Grant Achatz and hearing all of this. And I thought, damn, if only I could make a second movie, because this is a great story to tell. And we tried to imbue that in the film. I think we did. I think we achieved that.
I think you did too. And, you know, what I found interesting, because I've interviewed Grant a few times, and the first time I interviewed him, he was chef at Trio in Evanston. So before he opened Alinea, and he was doing some fascinating avant-garde cooking back then. But I always found him to be fairly kind of, you know, consistent, generally fairly quiet. He got super animated with you when he's talking about Charlie Trotter and his relationship.
Yeah, I mean, if anyone who's read Life on the Line, which is Grant's memoir, knows that Grant and his father had a contentious relationship. And I wonder if in looking at, you know, if in wanting to work for Charlie the way he did, if in being seduced by Charlie's books the way he was, if he felt this kind of like hope in his heart that Charlie would be some sort of father figure to him, right? Like a professional mentor in that way, in much the way that Thomas Keller became for him and his career. And when that didn't happen, I think it was devastating for Grant. I mean, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but certainly that's really disappointing when you come to realize that the person you idolize is not at all who you thought they were. I think that that experience happens for a lot of young chefs who don't quite have the realization of what it takes to succeed at the level that both Charlie and Grant now were struggling and striving for. It's hard to keep dozens of people moving in a singular direction at a high level of excellence day in and day out. And when people don't rise to the occasion, when they refuse to ask themselves, how excellent am I today? What can I do to be more excellent? I can only imagine how frustrating that was for Charlie and why he would react the way he did.
It's clear that the chefs that stuck it out with Trotter for however long became better chefs and went on to do great things on their own. Do you think if Charlie Trotter was a chef today that he'd behave the same way that he behaved back then? And do you think in the era of social media and cancel culture that would be acceptable?
I think he would behave the way he behaved. I mean, if you ever have managed a team and there's someone who comes in that you have all the hope in the world for, who doesn't see the world in the same way you do and doesn't live up to what you would hope they would, it's a supremely frustrating experience. And so would he have acted the way that he did? Yes, probably yes, 100%. That's who he was on some level. But would he have been canceled? Yes, that too. So would he have found another way to reinvent himself? It depends on where you catch him in his career, right? I mean, if he were a young wunderkind being toxic in the kitchen, he might have been able to have the energy and the stamina to go do something else and reinvent himself. But towards the end, it was clear that he didn't have it in him to change, much less, you know, accommodate what was happening in the world.
Love, Charlie is in select theaters now, on demand on Apple and Amazon, so you can see it there. The film is called Love, Charlie, The Rise and Fall. Tell me about why you think he fell.
So in 2007, Charlie Trotter hosted his 20th anniversary dinner at the restaurant, and it has gone down in history as probably the most spectacular culinary event in Chicago food history ever. I mean, you had Daniel Boulud, Thomas Keller, Ferran Adria, and his brother. You had Pierre Hermé, Tetsuya Wakuda. There's more, and that just goes to show you how amazing it was that I can't even think of the other A-list chefs' names who were there, but it was an incredible event. Charlie had been at this for 20 years, making two different 10-course tasting menus every night. That relentless pursuit of perfection had started to take a toll, and he went for a jog that morning, and he had a stroke, and he passed out on the jogging trail. He was hospitalized that day, ripped his IV out, and insisted on going back to the restaurant in order to, you know, oversee this incredible event that he was hosting. I think the fall was a combination of things. I think it was his health was failing just by virtue of this inoperable brain aneurysm that he had and was dealing with. And he had actually passed out a couple times before that jogging incident, which many people didn't know. He was clearly struggling with alcohol, which we allude to and we show in the movie. He was having difficulty achieving balance in his personal life. He was married 3 times. And I think that Charlie's relentless pursuit of excellence consumed him and his identity. And in the end, he just got so far away from his authentic self, which is Chuck, who he was before he opened the restaurant, we argue in the film, that by the time the restaurant closed, there was no other role to play. He was too far gone, and he died a year later.
Yeah. I have two little anecdotes. One, I was at a birthday party at a private room at Charlie Trotter's, and the host of the party knew Trotter. And Trotter came out to introduce himself, and he said, "Hi, I'm Chuck." And it always struck me. It's like, I didn't know if he was saying that to be pretentious, but after watching your film, I realized, oh, there's a Charlie and there's a Chuck, and they're two different people in some ways. And the other anecdote is I was in Whole Foods in Lincoln Park one day having some ramen at their little counter that they have there, and I see Charlie Trotter, and he looked terrible. I mean, I remember saying to myself, is that Trotter? And like 3 days later, he died. And you could just see kind of the downfall right there.
You know, it was really a challenge for me in making the movie, deciding how deep did I want to go into the downfall and how much of the alcoholism, for example, did I want to unpack? Because as soon as you start talking about a chef who's an alcoholic, the whole movie becomes about alcoholic chefs. And that was just a symptom of this bigger identity crisis that he was in the midst of. I heard that story, David, from dozens of people who worked for him that they would see him around town, and he was like a ghost, a bloated, just ghost of his former self. And I think you see that very clearly in the movie. And I didn't want to make downfall porn with this because I felt like this is his definitive legacy piece. I wanted people above all to come away feeling inspired by his story more than anything.
And the downfall, when you talk about alcoholism or whatever, it's not like, you know, he just consumed too much because he became a glutton. There was a lot going on in his life and his professional life. And I think he realized that in some ways he was getting overtaken, whether it was by Grant Achatz or he wasn't given the credit that he was due. And you have a great scene in the movie when he's giving a speech and you talk about Bourdain getting up there and go, I can't believe these people in the audience are not, you know, listening and revering every word that comes out of this guy's mouth.
It's not surprising that the downfall starts when he begins to be physically incapacitated by this aneurysm. All the energy that he had that he poured into the restaurant and before that into writing his postcards or traveling the world, whatever he did, all that energy started to go away. He was losing a grip on himself. And that had to have played a huge role in how afraid he was. I mean, he didn't like to go to doctors. And when you feel you're losing your capacity for excellence the way that he was, that's horrifying on some level, you know?
Well, Chicago is a great restaurant town because of him. A lot of these chefs would have never come to town, including Grant Achatz, and passed and created even more greatness in Chicago. It's been fabulous talking to you about this because I feel like I'm getting a little bit of insight that I've never had. Everyone should go see this movie or pay for it on Apple or Amazon because it's a really interesting look at a chef, at creativity, at both a rise and a fall. And you've got great interviews with really interesting both culinary people and non-family members, great archival stuff, and a lot of letters. I assume that in part, that's why it's called Love, Charlie.
Yeah, we were really lucky. His first wife, Lisa, who married him back when he was called Chuck, he wrote 350 plus postcards to her. And we got access to all of them. And I read all of them. And he really wrote his life story before he ever lived it. And so in many respects, it was really remarkable to see that narrative arc kind of play out. He knew what his life was going to be and who he was and what he was going to accomplish. And it was pretty awesome. I feel very fortunate to have made this movie during the COVID lockdown because it gave us this bubble, this time to be able to explore him, to read these postcards, every single one of them, and to really get a glimpse at who he was as a human being. Because if we made this during normal times, I don't know that the film would have gone as deep.
Rebecca Halpern, writer, director of Love, Charlie. It's such a pleasure. Thanks so much for making the film. I've really enjoyed it. I've watched it twice.
I'm a huge fan of Check Please, and thanks so much for having me too, David. I appreciate it.
That's our show this week. Thanks for listening. You can learn more about filmmaker Rebecca Halpern at chicagobusiness.com. Our own Ali Marotti did a recent profile of her work. Remember to check our show notes for links to all the places we've talked about. The Dining Table with David Manilow is produced by the awesome Todd Manley at Crane's Audio Studio. Remember to follow us wherever you get your podcasts. I'm David Manilow. We'll keep feeding you the good things of life.